Good morning. I have the honor and pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Marcia Lovett. Marcia's work addresses higher level cognition, and her research on learning and problem solving is particularly focused on our conference theme of cognitive change. I think this is a particularly opportune time for such a talk for a number of reasons. In recent years, there's been tremendous productivity, both experimentally and in computational models of learning, in advancing understanding of basic, you might say, lower level processes of cognition, like memory, categorization, property induction. At the level of the kinds of processing many non-human animals are capable of, that productivity provides us an opportunity to return stronger and smarter to some of the original questions that motivated the start of cognitive science. How are humans capable of complex problem solving and so flexible in learning to become experts in so many domains, like learning statistics, as you'll hear about from Marcia? Marcia's research program is a great example of building upon rigorous experimentation and modeling of lower level cognitive processes to address issues of higher level cognition. From her research on the Stroop task and strategy choice and problem solving, to her advancing understanding of student learning in areas like statistics, and how that learning can be dramatically improved through cognitive science applications, particularly in blended educational technology implementations. Marcia has published in many scientific journals like Cognitive Science, JEP General, Cognitive Psychology, but also in forums that reach educational practitioners. The importance of her work is also recognized by her many funders over the years, including NSF, ONR, Hewlett, and Spencer, who's sponsoring some of the work she'll talk about today. In addition to being a great researcher, Marcia is an incredibly generous person who contributes insights in every meeting and collaboration she's involved with. And she's never worried about being scooped. She's always more concerned with helping others. And on a personal level, I'm particularly grateful for Marcia's contributions on the executive committee of our Pittsburgh Science of Learning Center, which I direct at Carnegie Mellon. In fact, I'd like to publicly thank you, Marcia, for your contributions to our executive committee that you volunteered so generously. That kind of generosity is also reflected in her position at Carnegie Mellon, not just as a faculty in our psychology department, but also as the associate director of our Eberle Center for Teaching, where she helps faculty across our campus in applying cognitive science to improve their teaching. Her commitment to applying cognitive science research to improve student learning is clear, and you will see that in her talk. And like you, I'm very much looking forward to her talk, so I will turn it over. Please welcome Marcia Lovett.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here. I'd like to thank the organizers for this opportunity, as well as for putting together a very enjoyable program. Of course, I'd like to thank Ken for his kind introduction and the funders who made this work possible. The specific problem I'll be addressing today is instructional design. The goal of instructional design is to devise activities, feedback, and pedagogical strategies so students can learn deeply. This is a hard problem, as I'll discuss shortly, so it's not surprising that it has been the focus of study for many years. As I talk about instructional design today, I'll take it as a case study of how cognitive science methods and theories can be used to solve such a challenging and important problem. I'll begin by demonstrating how cognitive modeling can improve on long-standing approaches to instructional design. I'll present a tool that we developed called the Digital Dashboard for Learning that builds on this model. And then I will present some results that show this approach, when applied to an introductory statistics course, leads to accelerated learning by real students in real classes. And here's a preview. In a traditional college course, take Carnegie Mellon undergraduates learning introductory statistics. It typically takes them more than 100 hours of learning, and they show about a 3% learning gain. In contrast, in our adaptive data-driven course, These students spend fewer than 50 hours, that is less than half the time as the traditional course, and reliably and consistently show learning gains on the order of 18%. It's an enviable improvement, I think. And what's the difference? I'll argue that the approaches I'll talk about today are the main difference, and they incorporate many of the ideas and principles from cognitive science. Results such as these show that cognitive science methods can improve and create new solutions to problems. I'd also like to make the case for the approach that I'm discussing in more general terms, that is a general approach that involves adaptive data-driven design. And I think this approach can not only help us solve new problems, but change our thinking about the ways to address those problems and in fact give a whole new perspective on how instructional design research is conceived and conducted. But to get there, let's first consider why instructional design research is so hard. Instructional design is hard in one sense because there's such high variability in the data. There's variability between individuals in their background, prior knowledge, and so forth. There's also variability within individuals across topic domains, across time as they learn, and so forth. There's also high variability across learning contexts. This variability is not just noise in the data. There are systematic effects here that we need to account for in understanding when and where different instructional designs will be effective. So that's one area of complexity. The other is that this is actually a very high-dimensional search space. There are many factors that we can vary in terms of the way we design instruction. Here are a few: spacing of practice, timing of feedback, do we give students worked examples or ask them to solve problems, and many more. Research has studied these factors and typically pits the two ends of the spectrum as a binary choice. But I think it's important also to note that there are many levels within each of these factors. Moreover, each of these factors for creating an instructional design may have complex interactions with each other. So it's important to consider how they combine, which means we have combinatorial complexity in finding what's the best instructional design for a particular situation. And thanks to Ken, here's a demonstration of how complex that gets. If we're asking the question, what's the best instruction, we start with, well, should we give masked or distributed practice? Well, there's actually a third potential level we might want to consider. Combine that with the question of what kind of practice we give students, studying examples, solving problems, or some mix. That adds another factor to the design. Maybe the examples are concrete or abstract. The feedback and so on adds a lot of different combinations we need to be studying. The sense of the high dimensionality of the situation needs to be combined with the high variability I spoke of. So that means that in addition to those different factors, we have many strata on which to block and covariates to include in our analysis. So just a quick back of the envelope computation here. With 15 instructional factors, 3 options per factor, and 2 stages of learning, it's a lot of cells we need to study. Clearly a big problem. What I'd like to talk about today is how we can exploit technology to address this challenge, and I'll use cognitive modeling techniques to represent the domain in a way that matches how students learn, and then use that model of the knowledge components in statistics to guide effective instructional design, enable tracking of students' learning, and actually show that this improves students' learning in real classrooms. So, to start with the first topic. Part of the difficulty of instructional research, like I said, is that it's a very big search space. And so conducting any one experiment really means that you have to put in a lot of resources to buy a certain level of validity. And I'll argue that the best research in the field is still constrained to this resource validity frontier. And by resources, I mean some things like the sample size of the study, the time students are spending learning a particular task, and maybe the infrastructure that's needed to be built to conduct that instructional design research. In terms of validity, I mean both the internal and the external validity combined so that both factors are considered. And if you think about a particular experiment, maybe a small-scale experiment would be here on that resource validity frontier. It doesn't take a lot of resources if the number of factors are small or the sample size is small in the laboratory, and there's a certain level of validity that one can get from that kind of study. Scaling up that experiment would actually shift that dot along the curve, maybe to the point of this point where you have a full-blown classroom intervention, where the resources that are put into that are greater, and potentially the validity, in particular the external validity of such a study, would also be greater. Moving that along all the way to the far end, you might have an example of instructional design research, such as curricular reform, where the resources put in are very high, and the validity, both internal and external combined, would also be high. Suffice it to say, though, that I think a lot of the research done in this field is still limited to this frontier, which means that the more validity we want in our work, the more resources we need to pay. Educational technology, I think, offers a way to leverage what we're seeing in online instruction to improve the situation. So as many of you are probably familiar, online instruction is increasingly common these days. It comes in many different modes and forms. There are videotapes of lectures being put online. There are computer simulations that students can play with, all the way to courses that are fully online and can substitute for college credit. This online instruction increases students' access, their flexibility in learning, and 24/7 access, as well as potentially the productivity of instructors and students. The only caveat is that these online instructional modes may or may not produce learning gains. Meta-analysis from a recent DOE report suggests that is not always the case, that these will be successful. So what I like to focus on is a particular kind of online instruction that I call I4 online instruction, where that online instruction is integrated into an authentic environment, it's interactive with the student, highly instrumented for data collection, and intelligent in terms of adapting to the student's responses. And I'll argue that this I4 online instruction can shift that resource validity frontier upward. That is, when it's integrated into an authentic environment, we automatically have some increase in external validity. The interactive nature of these online instructional systems allow us to track students' steps of cognition, not just their final answer, but we really want to study, that is, their processing along the way. So that increases potentially some internal validity. With online instructional environments, we have an automatic way to instrument the system, and that is a nice way of collecting larger and richer data sets for a given level of resources. And these systems also offer the potential of adaptive design and even micro-experiments for conducting instructional design research in a way that is transparent to the user. As an analogy, think about Google. Every time you do a Google search, you're taking part in an experiment. That experiment might involve the different algorithms used to order the search terms that come back from your query, or it might involve the different advertisements that pop up in the sidebar. But whatever the case, that experiment is transparent to you, the user. Google, on the other hand, is collecting large and rich data sets without you having to bother. And as a result of this whole overall system of leveraging the technology, they have an automated way to design, collect data, and analyze that data to improve their search algorithms' performance. Same thing with online instructional technology. We can use these systems to give a better result to the user, that is the learner in this case, and a more effective platform for the developer, or in our case, instructional design researchers. There's a lot of this I4 online instruction going on in Pittsburgh, as well as the adaptive data-driven approach that I'll be talking about. The Pittsburgh Science of Learning Center is a joint venture between Carnegie Mellon and the University of Pittsburgh. It includes both Learn Labs, which are a platform for research where researchers interested in learning can conduct in vivo experiments where students are using online instructional technologies, particularly cognitive tutors, computer-mediated learning environments. It also offers the data shop, I'll mention a little bit later, that provides a suite of data analysis tools for analyzing the data that come from those Learn Labs. We also have Carnegie Mellon's Open Learning Initiative, which builds fully online courses that enact instruction, have all the pieces, and then the tool I'll be talking about today is the instructor's digital dashboard. Because I'll be focusing on the OLI statistics course later, let me describe it more here. This course exemplifies the I4 features. Like I said, it's a full course, so it's integrated clearly. It's interactive, as I'll show you in a quick demo, and it enacts instruction for the whole course. So what I mean by that is students read text online, they answer questions, solve problems, and complete quizzes. This OLI statistics course is a first semester course for undergraduates, and it can be used independently, that is by a student on their own going through the material, or it can be used with an instructor in what we call blended mode. And I'll be talking about research that involves the latter. Let me go to a demo. Just to give you a feel for what students in this system are able to do, this is a first screen showing the overall introduction to the OLI statistics course. It involves data analysis and inference, as well as probability. I'll scroll into a particular part on histograms where students can read text, see diagrams. This is a little applet they can interact with. And as they progress through the material, they have opportunities to learn by doing, where they can click on a link and have instructions for analyzing a data set. This one is set up to work with Excel. Other stats packages are the option. Students can also answer questions throughout. These are comprehension checks as well as questions that tap their deeper understanding. These quizzes or questions offer feedback, and students can also request hints. So as you see, as students go through this online instructional environment, there's a lot of opportunity for us to learn about their learning by collecting clickstream data. And that's one of the things we do. So now that we have a platform, these online instructional environments like the OLI statistics course, what I want to talk about next is how we can apply some cognitive science techniques, in particular knowledge component modeling or cognitive task analysis, to represent the domain of statistics in a way that matches how students learn. That is, we want to understand what exactly are the pieces of knowledge that students need to learn and how are they able to do that. So, what do students need to learn? I want to argue that all instructional design is really based on a model. That may be a model of what knowledge students need. It may be a model of what will help students learn it. And these models could be implicit or explicit. They're often implicit, especially when the instructional design is conducted by a domain expert, which is most often the case, especially in college courses. However, there is a problem, and there is some research to support the fact that domain experts have difficulty in several ways. First of all, they have difficulty breaking down complex skills into learnable chunks. This is because, as experts, they've automated a lot of those skills, and so they can't any longer see the pieces. They have difficulty identifying areas students will find difficult, estimating how long students will take, and overall, predicting what it actually is that will help students learn. It's been a while since they've been in students' shoes, so unfortunately, what that means is that domain experts' instructional designs often suffer from this expert blind spot. So these instructional designs sometimes are prone to use a knowledge decomposition that is too coarse relative to students' representation. It presumes some knowledge of skills that students may not have. It may involve over-practicing the easy skills and under-practicing difficult skills because of that mismatch that experts have. It also may not allow enough time or repetition or practice for students and often overlooks hidden skills. These are the skills that experts take for granted that can be very important to novices. A particular example of that is planning an approach to solving a problem. So what this means is that being an expert in an instructional domain is an asset for performance, but it's actually a liability for designing instruction. So that's where we can bring in some of our cognitive science techniques. In particular, I'll be talking about cognitive task analysis. The goal of cognitive task analysis is to identify the set of knowledge components that are required for good performance in a task domain. And I'll refer to knowledge components in shorthand as KCs. These knowledge components, or KCs, can be skills, facts, even metacognitive knowledge. And here are some examples from the domain of geometry. You might have the fact, the knowledge component that the area of a circle is pi r squared. There might be a skill that is a knowledge component in that domain of finding the area of a ring. You subtract the smaller circle's area from the larger circle's area, and finding the area of a frame, subtract the smaller rectangle's area from the larger. So these are just some example knowledge components from that domain. But the goal of cognitive task analysis is actually to specify these knowledge components in such a way that it captures how students learn in the domain. So they need to be of the right grain size. You need to parse that domain so that it matches the way students are learning. And the difficulty is that there are many knowledge decompositions possible. So going back to the example of computing area, it could be the case that students learn this by having two separate knowledge components, one for computing the area of a ring and a separate knowledge component for computing the area of a rectangle or a frame. It may similarly be just as possible that students actually have a more general knowledge component that is computing the area of any circumscribed region that covers both of those other two cases and many others as well. So what we'll be doing, I'll be talking about the work we did in specifying the knowledge components that best capture how students learn statistics in this introductory statistics course that I talked about, the OLI statistics course. Some possible knowledge components in that domain are what counts as a quantitative variable, what graphic should we use as a student to display two quantitative variables, and how and when does one compute correlation coefficient. What I've done is I've compared two different knowledge component models for this domain. One is based on the instructor's course design, and the other is based on a cognitive task analysis. Now, the instructor's course design is basically the knowledge component model based on the instructor's design is given by the specification of learning objectives that the instructor made and the instructor's decomposition of the knowledge domain into pieces. It turns out that that knowledge component model is really focused on the separate tasks that students need to solve in being good performers in statistics. The cognitive task analysis, on the other hand, breaks down the knowledge into skills, pieces of those tasks, skills that students must strengthen as they go through the statistics course. So there's going to be a difference, as you'll see, between these two knowledge component models. And the question is, which one better fits the way students learn this domain? How do we decide which one fits better? Well, we compare the knowledge component model's prediction to the data. And the way we do that is by applying a well-known result on learning that students' learning improves with practice according to a law that involves marginally decreasing returns. So a knowledge component model basically specifies what are the elements that are being practiced. And then by matching up those students' data for those different practice opportunities, we can see how well their error pattern, their error profile, reduces according to this marginally decreasing reductions function. So let me just give you a sample before I show you the full knowledge component models. Here's a sample from the instructor model. Consider the knowledge component that's a part of the instructor's view of what it is students need to learn. And that instructor's model has this component that an important skill to learn is how to describe a quantitative variable's distribution. This knowledge component is practiced in six activities in the course, so we can organize the error data for those six activities across the x-axis, and this is what we see. Apparently, this does not show a very smooth predicted learning curve, suggesting that this is not actually the way students representing the domain. Looking at those same six activities from the cognitive task analysis, the cognitive model's point of view, those activities are actually parsed into three separate knowledge components. In fact, the first three activities correspond to a knowledge component of interpreting a histogram. The next two, knowledge component from the cognitive model for interpreting a table, and the last one for interpreting a box plot. Now, if we take these knowledge components and organize the error data according to the first, second, and third repeated practice with each of these knowledge components, the data reorganized to look like this, and we see the learning. We see the decrease in error rate across practice opportunities. Averaging those over those three skills or knowledge components, this is looking a lot more like that learning curve that I showed you earlier. That's just a sample, though. What I actually did was develop the instructor's knowledge component model and compare it to the cognitive task analysis knowledge component model and look over all of those knowledge components over students' error data over the full course. What is the best fit? And the Pittsburgh Science of Learning Center Data Shop tools are very helpful in this regard, so I'm going to advertise for them here. Data Shop's available at this website. Basically, you can see here in the graph that these tools allow you to organize the data by a different knowledge component models, the red line being students' data, and the blue dashed line being the best fitting learning curve power function for those data. The way we conduct this analysis to determine which knowledge component model is best fitting is that for each knowledge component, that power function is fit to the learning data, estimating parameters specifically for each separate knowledge component. So comparing these two models then, we need to assess the goodness of fit. We do that by using the Bayesian information criterion, which is also known as BIC. BIC is the negative of the maximized log likelihood of the model under the data, so lower is better, kind of like a chi-squared goodness of fit statistic. Also, keep in mind that BIC penalizes for model complexity so that it's going to give preference to parsimonious models. Indeed, it does so in a way that's consistent, so as you get more data, you'll converge on the right model. Given this penalty function. I have the numbers here for the two models in terms of their BIC scores. The bottom line is that the cognitive model has a better fit to the data, even accounting for its somewhat greater complexity. That is, it has more knowledge components than the instructors. But since this quantitative view doesn't give you a good sense, I'll give you a few samples from the two models to give you a qualitative sense of where they differ. Looking at the instructor's knowledge component model, in the upper left-hand panel, you can see here's a knowledge component that has several practice opportunities, and you can see that the learning data, the error data profile, fits that power law curve fairly well. So that's a really good example of how that knowledge component is well matched to students' data. The other three knowledge components that are representative of the instructor's Casey model, however, show much more bumpy learning curves, and you can see that the best fitting power curve to those is pretty far off. It's not a very good fit. So in the instructor's Casey model, some learning curves are smooth, but many are not. In contrast, in the cognitive Casey model, here we have averaged over all of the knowledge components, the student's error data profile and the best fitting power curve overall. There's still room for refinement in this cognitive task analysis model, but overall, the fit is better with smoother learning curves. Now, let me give you a little sense of how the two models compare in head-to-head comparisons. In this particular example, at the top, I show the particular knowledge component from the instructor's model. And this knowledge component says, an important skill students need to learn is to describe the relationship between two quantitative variables. You can see that the fit is not very good, that the pattern of learning there is pretty bumpy. The cognitive task analysis actually splits that knowledge component into two separate skills or two separate knowledge components, one involving estimating R, the correlation coefficient, and the other involves interpreting scatter plots. You can see with this split of that knowledge component into two separate pieces, we have a much better fit to students' learning data. And this makes sense, actually, in hindsight, because think about students coming into a statistics class. They've probably already had a bunch of experience working with scatter plots and so forth from their earlier math courses. So you can see the error rate there is consistently low. However, this new skill or knowledge component for estimating R is not previously learned. So they start out with a high error rate and progressively reduce as they learn better how to estimate R. It's not just the case, however, that knowledge components in the cognitive model are always more fine-grained than in the instructor's model. So let me show you one example that goes the other way. Here we have in the instructor's model two different skills for checking axes on graphs and doing stuff like that. But the way the instructor has parsed the domain is to say that it's a separate skill when you do that in the chapter that deals with qualitative variables than it is for the skill when you do that for quantitative variables. So whereas in the instructor's model, these are two separate skills, in the cognitive model, they're actually identified as a single skill. And so we have a more parsimonious model with about equally good fit to the data. So capturing students' learning via this cognitive model of the pieces of knowledge that are involved in learning statistics is in and of itself kind of a nice result. Now we have a better understanding of what it is that's in the student's representation of the domain of statistics. But we don't want to stop there. What I want to talk about next is how we can use this cognitive model to guide instructional design, and then continue from there. I actually should call this redesign because the OLI statistics course was already designed before we did this. So what we found was that given the cognitive KC model, there were many knowledge components where there was insufficient practice given. That is, there were rather few opportunities for students to practice these skills. Some of them are listed here: identifying lurking variables, recognizing Simpson's paradox, applying the standard deviation rule, and so forth. This wouldn't be a problem if students get a small amount of practice with certain skills in a domain, as long as they're performing well. But as it turned out, for each of these knowledge components, student performance was rather poor. So this highlighted to the instructor and the course designers that this set of knowledge components was not getting enough practice. Interestingly, the instructor's KC model didn't reveal these deficiencies, and actually the course designers and instructors weren't aware of these particular areas of difficulty that students were having and the fact that the course wasn't giving sufficient practice in these areas. So as a result, the instructors and the course designers decided that they would adapt the course. Before this KC modeling, there were about, 379 activities in the course. All those different questions and problems that I showed you in the demo. They decided to add 65 new activities just specifically to target these challenging knowledge components that did not formerly have enough practice. The course designers also realized that their sense of the different learning objectives that students needed to achieve were actually rather coarse, and perhaps students and other instructors working with this course could benefit from a more fine-grained way of thinking about what it is students need to learn. So they actually ended up adding 12 new learning objectives and deleting three that were kind of vague or obscure. So what we have here is an example where the knowledge component model not only shows us something about an understanding of how students represent the domain of statistics, but an example of how this knowledge component model can offer feedback to the course designers. Now, that's a kind of adaptive instructional design that's occurring at a rather slow loop. We did all this cognitive modeling, the instructors and the course designers looked at the results and actually adapted the course design itself. What I want to talk about next is actually how we can use the results of this knowledge component model to allow for more tight loop adaptation in instruction with this course. And that is via offering feedback to instructors. In a typical course, think about it, the way instructors can track their students' learning is via graded activities. So in a regular face-to-face course, that might be by getting the distribution of exam scores. So maybe if you're thinking about your course that you teach, maybe your TAs give you some kind of an exam distribution like this, and that might tell you a little bit about how students learn and how your teaching succeeded in helping them learn. Unfortunately, with this kind of situation, the implications are rather coarse. You know that students got, on average, about an 80 on this exam, that some students fell above and below that mean, but it doesn't tell you very specifically where students faltered and where they had strengths. The other unfortunate feature of this approach, the typical thing, is that the results are often too late, in that you get this kind of result after a unit's completed and students have taken that unit test. Instead, what we'd like to do is offer instructors some knowledge component-specific predictions of how their students are learning, and to give them that information during a unit so they have time to adjust their instruction. The way I think of this is it's kind of like the difference between knowing your students got 80% on average on a test and being only able to predict that on the final exam, on an item, they're likely to get it 80% correct, versus having an item analysis of your early exam that tells you exactly which questions students performed well on and which questions students performed poorly on. So we can use the knowledge component model to do this prediction, and we do that by applying a hidden Markov model for each knowledge component in the cognitive model. And the HMM here looks kind of like this. The different states correspond to different levels of learning. As you go up, the learning strength is higher. And we have three parameters for each knowledge component in this model. One is P, the probability, the transition probability from one state to the next. And the other two parameters correspond to the output function. That is, from each state, what's the probability that a student will make an error? And those two parameters correspond to that power law function that I was talking about earlier. What we do is we fit this HMM to student data to estimate those three parameters. And then, based on a student's incorrect, correct sequence of responses to activities corresponding to a given knowledge component, we can predict their most likely state. So if a student got a question wrong, and then right, and then right, and then right, the prediction might be that the most likely state they're in, say, is state 2, and that gives us a sense of the degree of mastery students have for that particular knowledge component. We can use those predictions of students' level of mastery to convey that information to instructors, and it turns out that when instructors were first using these OLI statistics courses, they actually felt that they had an impoverished sense of information of how students were doing. Beforehand, when they were teaching face-to-face, they would have all these homework exercises, they would know how students were doing on homeworks and so forth, but in the online course, the OLI statistics course, homework is just working in the system, and so they wouldn't have those graded in the same way. So what we wanted to do was not only give them more data about how their students were doing, but give them cognitively meaningful information about their students' mastery. So we developed the Digital Dashboard for Learning. It's a tool for instructors that analyzes the data on students' interactions with the system. It presents to the instructor up-to-the-moment view of students' learning and communicates this in terms of the learning objectives. So we communicate with instructors and the world that they're thinking of it, but we organize the data that feeds into that communication according to that knowledge component mapping, the cognitive mapping, and the predictive model. Also, the DDL can allow for micro-experimentation, and we're working on a version that presents a view so students can track their own progress, but I won't be talking about those two features today. So I want to give you a sense of what this tool looks like and how instructors might use it. So say you're an instructor and you're teaching in blended mode with the OLI statistics course, and you've assigned your students to work through the first part of Module 2, as you can see here. The display here shows for each of the seven learning objectives in this unit, a little bar indicating the proportion of students who have mastered that skills corresponding to that learning objective, those who are in the yellow zone, and those who have not yet mastered the skills or the knowledge components corresponding to that learning objective. So a big green bar means that many of the students are in the higher learning states according to the Hinton-Markov model's prediction, and lots of red means they're in the lower level states. So let's say you're an instructor and you would assume by now that students in your course for that first learning objective, pretty much all of them should have mastered the material, so you want to learn a little bit more about what's going wrong. You can click on that top bar. This is just screenshots. And then you can see more detail on how students performed on the knowledge components that pertain to that learning objective. The left-hand side shows a dot plot display of individual students and how they're distributed in terms of their knowledge states. And the right-hand side actually shows for each knowledge component in the KC model, the cognitive KC model, what students' average percent correct for each of those knowledge components. So even though overall students have seemed to master this fairly well, many of those skills listed on the right have high accuracy levels, it is pretty clear from this view that the first two are rather low. So as an instructor, you could look at that. There's actually one layer deeper where you can see what the particular questions were that corresponded to those knowledge components and get a sense for, okay, if I want to target my instruction in tomorrow's class to help students get better at those two skills, I know what I need to do. And that in contrast, that contrasts with the situation where you just might review everything in the certain chapter that you were going to teach. So we have a situation here where given the I-4 instruction of this OLI statistics course and the digital dashboard, instructors can adapt their teaching based on moment-to-moment information of how their students are performing. The I-4 instruction offers those interactive activities with students that produce the data that are fed into the digital dashboard. The digital dashboard analyzes those data and gives up-to-the-moment reports indicating students' mastery of the material. And then, like I said, the instructor can adjust the activities that he or she is going to use in face-to-face teaching with students to best fit their needs. So now we have a situation where we have a knowledge component model that matches the way students learn. We have a tool that instructors can use to understand how their students' learning is for each of those knowledge components. Does it actually help? So what I want to talk about finally is a few studies showing that this approach does indeed improve student learning. The hypothesis that we're really testing here is, does this adaptive teaching approach, all the components that it has, lead to accelerated learning? With this kind of adaptive teaching, can students learn the same material as they would in a traditional course, but do so in shorter time and still show equal or better learning gains? So I'm going to show you quickly three studies that we conducted. The first involves a smaller class and an expert instructor. This was an initial study to collect baseline data on some standard measures and to test some new dependent measures. We then replicated that with a larger class and in the second study included a retention follow-up 4 months later. And finally, we've just this last spring replicated and extended to a new instructor, someone who had never taught with the OLI statistics course before. I'll show you the method for study one. Actually, the method is very similar across all three studies. What we do is students automatically or naturally enroll in the introductory statistics course. And we have about 180 students each spring coming into this course at Carnegie Mellon. We invite all of those students to volunteer to participate in a special section. In the first study, 68 students volunteered, and being cautious, we assigned 24 of them to our adaptive accelerated condition, but we did that according to stratified random sampling. The other 44 students served as our traditional control students, so they stayed in the regular section of the course. Let me give you a sense of how the two sections of the course differed. In the adaptive accelerated section, students attended 2 50-minute classes per week. They did this for 8 weeks of instruction, and their homework was to work through that OLI statistics course, completing activities according to a schedule. The tests that they took were 3 in-class exams, the final exam, and a standardized test called the chaos test that I'll describe shortly. On the other hand, the traditional section, those students attended 4 class sessions per week. They did so for 15 weeks of instruction, a standard semester. Their homework was to read the textbook and complete problem sets that they handed in each week, and then they had the same tests. I want to emphasize that the content in these 2 sections of the course was the same, but the kind of instruction was rather different. So in particular, if you look at the first row, in the adapted accelerated section, students were coming to class and they were not getting a standard lecture as in the traditional format. Rather, they were getting kind of a problem-solving session that the instructor had devised based on the reporting of the digital dashboard. So they were getting some targeted instruction that was based on what their learning data showed they needed more help with. The key factor that we want to make sure is true is not only is the adaptive accelerated section adaptive to students' needs, but it's also actually taking less time. We know that there are fewer hours in class, we know that there are fewer weeks, the tests take the same amount of time, but one possible question people might have is, well, perhaps it's the case that students in the adaptive accelerated condition were just spending lots and lots of time working through the OLI statistics course in such a way that compensated for the time gains in the other domains. So we conducted a brief time log study of students in both groups who were recruited to complete some online time diaries. It was self-report for both groups, and this was at an analogous point in the course, about two-thirds of the way through. We collected these time log data on 6 consecutive days from a Wednesday to a Monday. Here are the data. As you can see, there is no significant difference between the two groups, the light and the dark colors being the adaptive accelerated group and the traditional group. The striking effect is that students really don't do a whole heck of a lot of work unless it's Sunday evening. What you can see is that this effect across the board is marginal. There's no difference between the two groups. So we now have established that the adaptive accelerated condition is actually taking a lot less time for students. How is their learning? What are their learning outcomes? Our dependent measures of students' learning included the in-class final exam that was designed to be matched across the 2 sections. This final exam included multiple choice questions that were kind of fact-oriented and also short answer questions that were more problem-solving oriented. In fact, the short answer questions on the in-class final were fairly similar to the homework problems that students completed in the traditional section. We also conducted, as a dependent measure, the CAOS test that stands for Comprehensive Assessment of Outcomes in a First Statistics Course. And this CAOS test includes 40 multiple choice items that are designed to measure students' conceptual understanding of important statistical ideas. The nice thing about working in the domain of statistics is that people do a lot of good measurement statistics when they design standardized tests for this area. So we have content validity checks and reliability checks that this is a very nice instrument. I should also mention that the items on the KS test are rather well aligned with the content of the course, both sections, because they have the same content. And we administered it as a pre-test, post-test. Let me first show you the final exam results. Here we see that the adaptive accelerated group had the highest exam scores, but they were not statistically different from the traditional control or the traditional students overall. This is in some sense reassuring, like I said, because the OLI statistics course does not include quite as many of those open-ended or short answer questions like the final exam does. So our adaptive accelerated condition was doing at least as well on these problems. The CAOS test results show, here I have pre and post test results for the adaptive accelerated group, the traditional control, and also a national sample, just to show you that our Carnegie Mellon students are not that far from the norm. As you can see, the adaptive accelerated group gained a lot more on the pre-post administration of this test than did the traditional control. There's an 18 percentage point gain in the adaptive accelerated group and about a 3% gain in the traditional control. So just to summarize very briefly, less time, more learning. Let me go on to study two, which is a replication and an extension. We basically used the same method, same procedure, same instructor, but we wanted to make sure that the effect, the nice effect we'd seen in study one, wasn't just a result of a really small class size or just a fluke. So in this study, we had 52 students that were randomly assigned to the adaptive accelerated condition, and we also wanted to address the question that some folks might have that, well, even though in the adaptive accelerated condition, students are showing greater learning gains right after the course, what really matters is whether they can retain what they've learned for the, until the next semester when they, say, take their second statistics course. So about 4 months later, we conducted a follow-up study where we tested students' retention of the material and also ability to transfer. So in study two, let me just quickly show you the chaos test results. Here we have very similar results. In fact, it's again an 18% point gain in pre to post for the adaptive accelerated group, and this is a significantly larger pre-post gain than the traditional control. In the follow-up study, the goal was to study students' retention and transfer. We recruited students from both groups at the beginning of the semester following the main study. So I just want to point out that the adaptive accelerated group ended about halfway through our spring semester in the middle of March, whereas the traditional group ended their course at the beginning of May when our semester ends, and then there was a retention interval over the summer for both groups, and just about the middle of September, we brought students back in for this follow-up study. We had 13 students from the adaptive accelerated condition. They have about a 6-month retention interval, and we had 14 students come back from the traditional section. They had about a 4-month retention interval. So if anything, we're putting the adaptive accelerated students at somewhat of a disadvantage in this retention study. We gave them the chaos test. Here I've plotted the original pretest, the original post-test, and then in green, the follow-up results on the chaos test. And what this result shows is that at that 6-month delay for the adaptive accelerated group, they were showing higher scores on the chaos than the traditional control. Here's the transfer problem that we gave students. This is an open-ended data analysis problem students were given where they had the statistics package they had been using during the course open and available to them. Students would read, a weather modification experiment was conducted to investigate whether seeding clouds with silver nitrate would increase the amount of rainfall. Clouds are randomly assigned to treatment group to be seeded or to the control group not to be seeded, and data were collected on the total rain volume falling from each cloud. There's a description of the data, and then students were asked to do whatever you think you need to do to answer this question. Does cloud seeding increase rainfall? Students' analyses in the stats package were recorded, and they were scored in terms of their appropriateness and correctness on a scale from 0 to 3 by a rater who did not know the conditions. And here we have the results. Although neither group really performed close to ceiling, it is the case that the adaptive accelerated group scored higher than the traditional control. So at a retention interval that's longer for the adaptive accelerated group, we're seeing that their learning gains, their greater learning gains, are maintained, and their transfer ability is at least as good or better than the traditional control. The study three that we just conducted this spring has the same method and same procedure, but what we really wanted to do was to make sure that these results were not just limited to a given instructor who was kind of experienced at working with the OLI statistics course and at using our DDL, our digital dashboard for learning tool. So we had a new instructor teach the adaptive accelerated group and the traditional group. As this was a fairly large class again, although not quite as large as study two, and we'll be conducting a follow-up study in this coming fall. I'll quickly show you the chaos test results for this study. Here again, we see that the adaptive accelerated group gained more pre-post test on the chaos did the traditional controls. And here the gain is about 13%, and again, only about 4% for the traditional control. So those are a quick summary of the results we've shown so far. And then I think I'll just quickly conclude to say that this adaptive accelerated approach allowed students to learn more in less time. It's really the combination of, I think, the cognitive KC model that allowed us to understand the nature of students' learning and their representation of the statistics domain, combined with the OLI statistics course that enabled us to feed data into the DDL and give instructors information so that they could adaptively teach students in that particular, in that special section of the course. Just to highlight much of this intervention and the way we designed the OLI statistics, the way we designed the DDL to help instructors adapt their teaching aligns with cognitive science research. There are still many open questions. I'll just highlight two very quickly. Because there are various things going on between the experimental and control group, we still need to address this question of what exactly is the mechanism, what's the particular feature that's driving this effect. I can say that other studies we've conducted where students only had the OLI statistics course and their teacher did not have access to the DDL, we did not see the striking improvement on the order, anything close to the order of 18% learning gains on the chaos test. So that's suggestive that this is an effect of the DDL and adaptive teaching. But we do need to do more head-to-head comparisons in that regard. And then another question, I think, for future work is to consider where else these effects might be possible. Is there a set of domains or disciplines where this approach can really leverage the cognitive task analysis and adaptive teaching, or are there some domains where we'll get less of an impact? And so those are areas for future work. And with that, I'll thank my collaborators and thank you for your attention.
I so feel that it's very much a matter of art, and that the first cognitive task analysis is almost certain to be wrong, and maybe the fifth and the tenth attempt will also be wrong. And as a specific example, Val Shute developed a tool to support cognitive task analysis, and she demonstrated it with an introductory statistics course. Have you ever looked at that
analysis
to see how it relates to this?
That's a good point. It's been a long time, but I actually did work with StatLady, the tutor that she developed based on that cognitive model, and I haven't thought about going back to compare the knowledge components in this cognitive analysis with that one, but I will say the interesting thing is when we took this cognitive task analysis approach, we were looking to identify the separate skills that students needed to practice. And even the first pass cognitive task analysis was a much better match to students' learning data than the instructors. So I think that's really an important distinction, that it helps us to remember that domain experts often don't have as easy access, or they're kind of not the best ones to identify what are the pieces of knowledge that students need to learn. The suite of tools that DataShop offered certainly make it easy for me to refine this cognitive task analysis, and I'll certainly be doing that because, as even the results I showed, allowed for some room for improvement. Oh, John?
These are nice results, but I want to ask about the glass half empty rather than the glass half full. Which is that if you look at your students, they're still not something maybe that instructors would be proud of. So the question is, what is the ceiling on achievement? Sort of, do you have some sense of how much better we can really do with students?
I think that's a really good question. If you notice, the chance on, say, the chaos test was about 40%. When students take the chaos test at pretest, they get about 50%, and they get almost 70% 72% on this multiple choice test of conceptual understanding when they exit this introductory course. I have two answers to that question. One answer is actually the chaos test is actually a test of fairly deep conceptual understanding of statistical concepts. So scoring 72% on average is actually a pretty nice result. And I think that in a lot of cases where such tests have been devised and administered, we find that students can come out of these introductory lecture courses with a lot worse learning gains and with a lot worse actual achievement. So that's my first answer, that I think it is really half full. With regard to the half empty, I think what we can do is we can actually perhaps further leverage the techniques here to see, are there particular areas in the OLI statistics course? We have very rich data on students' performance as they go through the course, and we can see if there are particular areas in the course where it's not actually serving students as well as it could. They're practicing something, they're practicing it multiple times, but whatever the case, their error rate isn't going down. And so by continuing to analyze the data coming out of this course, I think we can refine our design of the course to really target those challenging skills and continue the process that I've started. I should mention that all three studies that I talked about were conducted before these adaptations to the OLI statistics course design. So there's a hope that with those 65 new activities targeting the challenging knowledge components, we might actually see some benefit in chaos test performance next time students take the course using this OLI statistics. So that's my answer. I saw a hand back there. Yes.
It seems clear, I don't think it's particularly controversial, that the problem-based adaptive conditions would do better. My concern is the focus on efficiency or speed of the learning that they get. Why is your group interested in looking at range and magnitude of transfer and facilitation of that by, you know, more facile perception of the dimensions of transfer on the part of students and other issues? I think that's really the fertile territory where people want to see some, you know, magnitude, you know, large magnitude gains, especially in an area like statistics, where the experience and practice of application is so very critical. So that was my question.
Sure. Well, one of the reasons that we designed these adaptive studies to focus on the acceleration of learning is really for two reasons. One is that oftentimes when studying instructional effects in real classroom situations, regardless of the strength of the intervention, students will compensate because they're getting a grade for this course and they want to do well. So what we wanted to do was to create a situation where we could see a little more sensitively through learning efficiency and learning gain measures, is this new approach working well? I definitely am not one to push for just learning, going through the curriculum faster. What I think this approach affords is an opportunity for students to spend their time, especially their time with the instructor, more wisely. And I think one of the things that I guess I would agree with you on is that that time that the students spent with the instructor was not on the basics. It was not on how do I compute a t-statistic or something like that, but rather on those more application problems that the instructor could pull to make sure that students were doing well on the challenging skills. So I think that in future work, it need not be that we study this in a half-semester environment, but we can look at both fixing the time and looking for greater, deeper learning gains. I would be just as pleased with that kind of result.
One more question.
Oh, sorry. I don't know.
I have a question about your knowledge component model. And that is, it seems to focus on
the correct conceptions, correct components. I'm wondering, is there a role for misconceptions intuitively as an instructor, it seems to me I'd like to know what are those misconceptions I'm trying to drive the student away from. So in your system, is there a role for misconceptions?
That's a very good question. And in fact, the inspiration for a lot of this work is the cognitive tutor methodology, where a knowledge component model includes both sort of expert or good student knowledge components as well as what we call buggy knowledge components, or the misconceptions. And although we don't have that in place yet, it is the case that we would like to add to the knowledge component model the ability to tag particular responses, incorrect responses, to particular misconceptions. If we do that, not only could we tell instructors where students are weak versus strong, but we could have this on, nice feedback loop for collecting the data to identify, well, of the 7 misconceptions that are seen in Module 2, this is the one your students are really exhibiting. So that's the one you want to squelch. So yes, that would be a great area. It's a possibility, but we haven't done that yet. Thank you.
Okay, we have an announcement, but before that, let's thank Marshall.
Thank you.